Cheer up, man. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Got it right. By Thor, you do. Yeah, this is Thor's Day. Yeah. I'll forego the Thor entry this week. Maybe put it on every other week or something, but I like that. Thor. Yeah. Hey, it's the 5th already of November, and it's 70 degrees out. I can't believe it. When I was a kid around here, I used to hunt rabbits in the snow in November. Because rabbit season started on the 10th. That's right. Well, thank goodness for global warming. The non-whites and weirdos that live around the coast. Now, wait a minute. That may be some of our guys. I'm sorry. But the water's rising. We who got things pretty well figured out. We're here in the middle where we got quite a bit of elevation here, man. So bring on these warm falls and winters. It's okay with me, man. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations for the show and put the word out, get some more people subscribing to the show because I think they need it because all they're getting is Alex Jones shit on the right and a lot of this right-wing nonsense that supposedly a lot of our own friends are putting out. But that's all right. I go my way and they go theirs. See, it's been about at least 25 years since I got kicked out of the right wing. But that's sort of like the boss saying, you're fired. You can't fire me, I quit. Well, let's see here. One of our sneaky little spies sent me some information here on that they picked up on the internet. Actually, it's no big deal. They got it from the Southern Poverty Law Center. If you want to know what's going on, who, where, what, and meetings in the right wing, just tune in to the SPLC. They'll have it there in spades, I'll tell you. Funny part about it is that some of their stuff is true about the right wing. And so that's funny. Anyhow, I see that the white nationalists, National Policy Institute, boy, that sounds important, conference was in Washington, D.C. this past weekend. They had a familiar lineup of speakers, but NBI head Richard Spencer's event turned out to be far different from your average radical right gathering. Well, let's see here. First place, I never heard of Richard Spencer in my life, but that doesn't, I can't know everybody, but if he's going to be leading some big-ass new group, it'd be interesting to know where in the hell he came from. Spencer, a relatively young racist activist himself, was able to do something many similar groups have failed to do, attract lots of young people to his event. Well, I'll tell you, now that Willis Cardo has bit the dust, and I just found out about that, I guess he died last month, sure they'll probably get more young people in, because I remember when Cardo ran his yearly get-together up usually around L.A., everybody encouraged him, I know I did, to reserve special two or three rows down front for young people and college kids and let them in free, which he was charging, I think, $30-$40 to get into this thing on revisionism. And he refused to do it. He wanted that moolah, and so they didn't get many young people in. But if they give them, yeah, they should, if they're smart, give them a free ticket, you know. And he did something else. Now, this is really something. He did something else white nationalists aren't known for. Spencer made it clear that anti-LGBT voices would not be invited. Huh. That is a first. Well, it's not surprising, because there's been a strong current of homosexuality in the right wing for decades. Believe me, I could write a book on that. Rick Cooper was writing a book on it, too, before he died. It reached into the highest echelons of the right wing racist struggle. And so, so now they're finally coming out and being four square and saying, come on down here, homosexuals. Well, I don't see why homosexuals, a lot of them are in the closet. They show up and go to any meeting they want. They don't have to make a big deal out of it. Every other kind of extremism, and in particular anti-Jewism, was perfectly welcome. How about that? Says here that before the event got started, I guess it was last week, Spencer took steps to attract many young racists as possible, as many, including offering a hefty discount for those under 30, something he's done before. Discount? You should let them in free, you cheap bastard. He also stipulated that only first names would be on the name tags worn at the conference, thus relieving fears of exposure. What? That guy nuts? You get a bunch of right-wingers together and they blab their mouth off. Where you work? Oh, I work right over here. I'm in the Defense Department. You want to see my driver's license, you know? First name, just wearing first names on a name tag is going to relieve fears of exposure. Look, before they left that building, they were all categorized and on the ADL list, believe me, because there's ADL infiltrators all the time. Always was, always will be for any kind of public crap like this. As the conference began, Spencer encouraged the crowd to take to Twitter during the event using the hashtag #BecomeWhoWeAre, and attendees duly obliged, posting pictures and quotes from some of the speeches. Oh, let it all hang out there, baby. Okay, here. After lunch, NPI director, have you ever heard of NPI? Well, I must be, I've been out of the right wing a long time, I guess. After lunch, NPI director William Reginary, who I've never heard of either, he could be from the Defense Department for all I know, asked all of the participants under the age 30 to gather in an adjacent room to take photographs. Oh, yeah, for fundraising purposes. Yeah, I got to get those funds. The right wing has never failed to get out there and get those funds. I wonder how much Willis Cardo's got left all that money stole out of the Gene Farrell account. I wonder if he didn't have any kids, so I guess his wife will get it all and probably go back to Germany where she's from. Interesting. About half of the crowd of 120 heeded Reginie's call. Yeah, we want you all over here in this room where we can take your pictures, and the first one at the ADL office gets $50. Now, they're going to get these young, probably college guys, bright kids, a lot of them, maybe dressed in a suit, look decent, you know, the whole bit. And they're going to be on the list. And when they go for good jobs, forget it. When they go try to go in the military and climb up in the military, forget it. They're going to try to get into Wall Street and climb up, forget it. You've been exposed. And here comes Anonymous right behind them. So anyhow, then it says here anti-Semitism, but I'm pretty sure that they're not anti-Arab. Anti-Semitism was widely accepted at the NPI event this year, something that was not necessarily the case at its February 2015 and October 2013 gatherings. The anti-Semitic tabloid, the American Free Press, had a booth at the event staffed by John Friend, a younger anti-Semite who runs the website and the radio show Realist Report. Well, I have heard of him. I don't remember having much contact with him, but I remember him. Brochures of the AFP's sister publication, The Barnes Review, that was a Cardo money pot, were also distributed by a friend at the event. Well, Barnes Review had some good articles in it. I won't deny that. TBR is America's leading Holocaust denial journal. Yeah. The anti-Judaism did not stop there. Before his full remarks, longtime racist Sam Dickinson. I remember him. I don't think I ever met him. He was asked by Richard Spencer to say a few words about Willis Cardo, the anti-Semite who founded the TBR and was active on the radical right for 60 years before his death in late last month. Well, and I just got the word. Cardo was more than a radical right winger. Cardo was a full-blown Nazi. He sued somebody. I forget who it was. I should remember, but his suit was thrown out of court because there's so much evidence that he was an active Nazi with his yearly Adolf Hitler birthday parties. I went to a couple of them on the West Coast. Willis Cardo, the anti-Semite who founded TBR, was active in... I read that. Dixon sang Cardo's praises, calling him the foundation, and went on to say, "It is incalculable the number of people he put together, and this group would not exist today, I suspect, if it were not for Willis Cardo." Well, there's a lot of things. Well, you know, this thing of letting LGBT or whatever people into the meeting, well, that's nothing new. Cardo's the man that did all the printing on Cardo's books that he sold for Noontide Press and so forth was a pedophile. Yes, a known pedophile. He'd been charged. There's court records to prove it. So Cardo didn't have any problem with those kind of people early on. As I recall, this pedophile, his main attraction was little Central American boys up in L.A. Cardo knew all about it. This guy printed books for a lot of other people, too, in the right wing. Even all the Christians that would yell and scream about homosexuals, going to hell, going to burn in hell. But they'd buy their books printed by a pedophile. Dixon ended his remarks by asking the crowd to give thanks for Cardo's commitment to our race and also his commitment to all that Gene Farrell money. I knew him so far back, and boy, there's a lot more I could talk about, but I don't want to take the whole show talking about the wonderful Willis Gardo. Anti-Semites were welcome to the NPI event, but a move not normal in these circles, anti-gay voices were kept away. Well, hell, the Institute for Hysterical Review had several homosexuals in it working right in their office. Cardo had no problem behind the scenes working with homosexuals and, like I say, his pedophile printer. So that's no surprise to me that they've gone this route, because, like I say, there's always been quite a strain of homosexuals, not only as members but in power. Now, if that's the way they want to go, that's okay with me. I'm not out looking under everybody's bed, like Hitler said. I'm not looking under everybody's bed. As long as they're not trying to play with my pee-pee, it's okay with me, I guess. The Traditionalist Youth Network, white nationalist Matthew Heimbach of the Traditionalist Youth Network, TYN, was disinvited. I don't think I've ever heard of that guy. According to his close friend Scott Terry, Heimbach was booted from the NPI conference for his anti-gay or homosexual views. Well, let's look at it this way. There's people who are proud to be heterosexuals and they don't prefer the homosexual life, and if they say so, suddenly they're anti-homosexual. While Heimbach was kept at bay, Jack Donovan, an openly gay white nationalist, served as one of the key speakers. Well, boy, the right wing is really getting there. Wait a minute here. I got to find it. SPLC did a pretty good job on this article, I must say. There might be a few details we might have to look into. In the middle of the conference, Spencer penciled in a live podcast with three other younger white nationalist radio podcast personalities. Mike Enoch of the Right Stuff blog, as well as husband and wife duo Hendrik Palmgren and Lana Lotteff, both of the white nationalist media group Red Eyes Creations, based in Gothenburg, Sweden. Though live broadcasting from racist events is nothing new, the participants were all young. Well, there's more people I have never heard of. Boy, oh boy. I guess it's because I could care less. In an effort to draw publicity to the event, Spencer held a press conference taking a page out of David Duke's playbook, and that's Dr. David Duke, inviting a half dozen journalists into the conference room at the National Press Club to pitch questions to a number of speakers, including Spencer and fellow white nationalists Sam Dixon and Keith Preston, as well as Frenchman and NPI keynote speaker Guillaume Fay and musician Robert Taylor. Well, none of these guys have ever darkened my bathtub. I don't know what the story is there. The interviewees didn't hold back, as articles in the Huffington Post, the Daily Beast, revealed. Dixon claimed African Americans could be given Manhattan, describing his version of a balkanization of America. Spencer spouted some anti-Semitism itself before trying to retract it, stating, quote, "The Jews exist precisely because they were part, precisely because they had, maybe you could say, a bit of paranoia about trying to stay away. Please don't quote paranoia." Jeez, that's sort of a screwy deal. The speeches were full of the same white nationalist tropes, such as opposition to immigration. Well, that's non-white immigration, I think. And lamenting the apathy of fellow whites in America and Europe who refuse to combat multiculturalism. Well, I say also white nationalists who refuse to say I'm a white racist separatist. I'm a white nationalist. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean in this day and age, a nationalist? And, you know, when they say I'm a European American, well, are you a European nigger American? I mean, you know, Europe's filling up with niggers, so you say you're European American, you can be a European nigger American. Anyhow, many of the speeches were more uplifting. Clearly a ploy by the event organizers. Well, of course, they wouldn't want to talk down, would they? Thus turning the event into something resembling a white nationalist pep rally. I wonder why they didn't invite Trump. Spencer's speech pumped up the crowd as he told for the umpteenth time the story of his imprisonment and deportation from Hungary in 2014 for attempting to host a white nationalist gathering in the Hungarian capital. I guess Cardo chose this term white nationalist along with David Duke because they sure got it going. The evening session certainly resembled a pep rally when Spencer again riling the crowd, now buoyed by alcohol. Ooh, and the prospect of a speech by Jack Donovan. Spencer had the crowd rolling with laughter during his introduction of Donovan, exclaiming that he was so happy to be at the press club and with so many cuckservatives. Cuckservatives? Sounds a lot like cockservatives to me. Maybe that was a little tidbit he threw to the homosexuals. He then joked lamely that he couldn't say much for the night because he had to help his wife truck in their two adopted Haitian babies named Snowflake and Jamal. Yeah, Donovan, like Spencer, is part of the white nationalist leadership that college-age males are looking up to, perhaps because they attempt to be cool and edgy. Donovan waltzed around the room that was distinctly not like one organized for a racist gathering. Gone were most of the tables and chairs, and in their place, open space, where the younger attendees formed a semi-ring around the speaker, while most of the older crowd sat at the back. Get the goddamn back of the bus, you old bastard. Just give us your money. We know you got the money. Donovan's impassioned speech gave young people tips on how to become a barbarian. Do you get that? He's giving these young people tips on being a barbarian. It seemed to me there's a lot of barbarian youth around already. I don't think they need to be taught. But most of them are on the other side. The title of his forthcoming book. He also provided a number of rules for barbarians, including not shedding any tears or spending time thinking about or trying to convince people who are not adhering to the white nationalist cause. Another of Donovan's rules was to loot and plunder, meaning to use technology and everything that the modern world has to offer to you to repurpose it to advance the white nationalist cause. Well, they're going to start chopping off some heads with a big sword. I got a big sword here. It was handmade for me years ago, presented to me as a trophy. It's a broadsword. It's about 6 foot long. When I strap it to my back, the point still rubs the ground sometimes. You mean use one of them? I'd like to use one of them on a lot of those congressmen and senators and all those people at the State Department and all that shit. While familiar younger white nationalists such as Patrick Sharp, Devin Saucier, Dan Poole, and even Thomas were all in attendance, it appeared the majority were new recruits of the Colonel. New recruits? I never heard of any of these guys talking about new recruits. I guess these are the web warriors. As Spencer told a reporter from the Daily Beast, talking to the Daily Beast is like talking down a commode. Before I felt like I knew everyone in the room, but now can't keep up with it. Though most of the young attendees at Spencer's event clearly live in fear of being exposed for being a racist. Well, if you're in fear of being exposed as a racist, the last place you want to go is this goddamn meeting. All those Duke and Liberty Lobby meetings and Willis Cardo meetings, they've always got. I knew most of the ADL agents that went into these meetings on the West Coast, like Roy Bullock and people like that, professional spies. And most of the time they let them in. They let them, the bastards, right into the meeting. It is clear that Spencer is making headway in cultivating social space, whether that be for real life or online, for these individuals, regardless of their sexual orientation. Okay. Well, there you go. That's the big event of the year. Maybe they have them two or three times a year if they can get enough money, because people pay, these right-wing confabs, people pay $300-$400 for plane tickets, fly all over the country, pay for hotels, pay for meals, pay for all that shit to hear something they should know already without leaving their house. You don't have to go to the meeting. The last place you want to go is these meetings. Well, the dollar crashes and everything falls apart. They're not going to be looking for these people to lead them through the streets and the rubble and the rabble. They're going to be looking at some pretty tough people, probably a lot tougher than I am. These guys will be hiding in the academic libraries on the university campus. Well, the big thing now is right wing. Everybody's an extreme right winger. Right winger this, right winger that. It's a very clever method of trying to rope everybody into one situation, which we don't want to be roped into. If you'll notice, these right wingers, so-called right wing extremists in Europe, a lot of them are more into just marching a la Hitler type parades and like that than they are really getting down to the brass tacks. Now, you know, you can have two refrigerators full of food, one left, one right. And you can take some food out of the right-wing refrigerator, you can take some out of the left-wing refrigerator, but you don't take it all out of either one. Because both the left and the right are full of nonsense. But there's a lot of important things involved in the left and the right too, if you look at it possibly. But the right wing, you got to remember, is always going to be controlled by the capitalist, predatory capitalist, no matter how they do it. Sort of like the Southern strategy for the Republican Party that used and abused the white racists for years, lying to them and so forth. Now they, of course, come right out in the open with, we want all the Negroes in our party. Well, I hope they get all the Negroes in their party. I wish all the Negroes in Chicago would go run down and join the Republican Party. Let's get it out there and see what they're going to really do, which is nothing. So beware of all this. You know, I see on the web here, some small guy in a small town won some election in Switzerland, and it's, oh my God, the right wing's taking over. Well, most of these guys, you don't know what they're talking about. You don't know their speeches. You don't know what. And most of these leaders on the right wing are so hungry for members and money, they'll take about anybody in. As you heard me talk about on this reading this morning, of this this new right-wing phenomenon with all these young people. Well, I wrote to, I put a note in there to that SPLC list and said, believe me, when the shit hits the fan, it won't be these guys leading the parade. It'll be the unwashed white beasts from the shadows. I guess they printed it, so we'll see what happens there. So, anyhow, don't get all infatuated with this, the rise of the right wing, because the right wing is very well manipulated, just like the left wing. So, keep separated. Lone wolf. That's the only possibility. And eventually, unconventional warfare. Yeah. But not yet. Nope, not yet. Some people will say, when already? Well, calm down. Relax. Have a beer. Just as long as worse is better, things are going fine. I can tell you pretty much who's right and who's wrong simply by this sentence that I came up with this morning. You can tell who the right people are by who their targets are. Think about it. Insults and name-calling is not it. I mean targets. And I screwed up here. I'm getting behind times on my books and so forth. I just looked, and one of our lone wolves from England sent me a copy of this book, The Partisan, and I haven't gotten into it yet. But I don't know too much about what it's about, but I'm going to find out. I'll have to read it, and then maybe I'll give it my review. But you can purchase it from Amazon for I think you can get them as low as £7.98, though, I think that is. Well, just go on up to Amazon and look around for The Partisan by Fenech, F-E-N-E-K, last name S-O-L-E-R-E. And they may be cheaper by now, I don't know. Well, just by the cover, the book looks a little like something like The Order, The Partisan. I like to see something in like this. You know, you got the Red Army faction. Too bad they were hell-bent on communism. Mix that up with the white racial separatists and call it the White Army. Well, we got one of those in Russia. Yeah, one of our friends over there calls himself the White Army. So, White Army faction, that rings pretty good to me. But the problem is with these groups that have been pretty effective in some ways, the left gets dragged over into Marxism, and the right gets drug into capitalism. Either way, you're screwed. That's not the way out. This is what they had on the Amazon as a description of this book. The Fifth Republic, son of a murdered activist during the Algerian War. The ambitious French Minister of Justice, Sid Ben Hassi, dreams of a pan-Arabian caliphate. But this is not the post-colonial revanchism of a haunted man. It is a logical product of decades of corrupt politics and misguided utopianism. The old European establishment, weak and morally bankrupt, is impotent. The ancient French, victims of their own selfishness and nihilism. Let's see here. See if I can get any more of this. And the resistance, yet the spirit of Charlemagne and Charles Martel, is not quite dead. A young resistance movement has emerged, determined to overthrow the Arabian conquerors. It's come to this. It's kill or be killed. La Petroleuse. Their best weapon is Sabine Orlok, a Petroleuse who leads a violent paramilitary cell, utterly ruthless. She will stop at nothing, but neither will the enemy. At stake is the future of Europe. Well, that sounds pretty interesting. I'll have to sit down and read it. The key word, of course, is ruthless. in any particular struggle that has tremendous odds, any word less than ruthless is not worth talking about. Well, I want to thank our lone wolf there in England for sending that book to me, and I'm sorry I get quite a bit of mail, and sometimes I stack it over on one side of my desk and almost forget about it, but I found it. Let's go back to Terror in the Night by Jack Nelson. The Klan's campaign against the Jews. As far as I know, they're only really against the Jews because the Jews were head over heels involved in the civil wrongs movement. But on the other hand, there's a hell of a lot of Jews in the South that were just as anti-black as these Klansmen were. I mean, to tell the truth. At least once, Terrence turned to robbery to finance his activities. He proved a calm, cool hold-up man. He remained in the back of the Kroger supermarket in Jackson after closing time on a Friday night until only a clerk doing last-minute chores remained in the store. Pointing a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol at the clerk, Terrence said, "Don't act like a hero, just open the safe." I like those .45 caliber semi-automatic pistols. When the terrified clerk told him that the only manager and the assistant manager had the combination, Terrence ordered him to summon the manager by telephone. Make up a good story, because if he brings someone with him, there will be a shootout with you in the middle. Unquote. The clerk made the call with the steel of the pistol's barrel on the back of his head, the safety clicking off and on. He told the manager he needed him to come help because the water pump had broken and it was flooding the produce area. As soon as the clerk completed the call, Terrence locked him in the meat cooler to cool off. About 30 minutes later, the manager arrived, a smooth-faced young man who looked to be hardly in his 20s. As the manager walked toward the back of the store, Terrence stepped slowly from behind a food display, pointed the pistol at his head, and said, "Hold it! If anyone is with you, or if the police come up, there will be a shootout, and you'll be in the middle." Unquote. Terrence forced the young manager to open the safe, then made him transfer $4,279 from a cash drawer to a paper sack. I would say not a very big haul. "Aren't you a little too young to be a manager, and won't this cost you your job?" Terrence asked. The manager agreed that he was young for the job and that the robbery probably would result in his being fired. "I'm sorry," said Terrence as he herded the manager into the meat cooler, "but it has to be done." Unquote. Terrence's partner, Kathy Ainsworth, meantime was continuing to live her bizarre double life, devoted grade school teacher and model citizen by day, a true female lone wolf, right-wing radical by night, racial radical by night, not right-wing. She taught her classes, helped her husband Ralph with his health club business, and played the role of typical young homemaker. With the help of her mother, for example, she had gone to the Kennington Company, a Jackson home appliance dealer, and arranged to buy a new kitchen range, a new refrigerator, and a washer and a dryer on the installment plan. The total bill came to $937.33, a considerable amount for a schoolteacher in the 1960s. But she put down $50 and agreed to pay $78 a month until the balance was retired. Her mother co-signed the contract. That's a smart move if she had a bundle of money. One thing the system looks for is people who spend a lot of money all at once. And these niggers that go out and sell a whole lot of dope or rob somebody that immediately start spending the money. And so they're pretty easy to track that way. Putting it on a payment plan was smart. The secret to her success seemed that she never let her two worlds overlap. Going back even to her own school days, she had seldom allowed anyone from her daytime world to glimpse in depth at her racist and anti-Jewish feelings. Very smart. In fact, Kathy Ainsworth was a second-generation hater. Well, it depends on who you hate. Along with the older brother, Anthony Capomaccia, Jr., Kathy had been raised in Miami, her mother born Margot Marchone in Los Angeles of Hungarian immigrant parents, was a Follies dancer who married Antonio Capomaccia, a circus juggler 12 years her senior in Juarez, Mexico in 1939. They later moved to Los Angeles, where Antonio Jr. was born in 1940. Subsequently, the father joined the traveling vaudeville show, and on July 31, 1941, Catherine Madeline Capomaccio was born in Chicago. They were Italians. During World War II, the USO hired Antonio Capomaccio as an entertainer, and he traveled from army camp to another, always taking his family along. Finally, in 1945, they settled in Miami, where he found work at resort hotels. The marriage, apparently never very stable, began to crumble. Mrs. Capomaccio constantly ridiculed her husband, often in the presence of others, and he would sometimes react violently. A childhood friend of Kathy's was quoted in the Miami Herald as saying, "Mrs. Capomaccio used to ridicule Kathy's father all the time in front of the children. It was like she hated all men. I can still remember her standing in the kitchen drying the dishes with us and saying that Kathy was just the product of an accident on a cold Chicago night." Kathy's father doted on her, but he sided with her mother in their many domestic quarrels. Her father, speaking in broken English, told the Miami Herald she was an angel, great big brown eyes, and everyone on the block adored her. Always so sweet, she always stayed round the house. Never go out in the street and play like a bad girl. But the deterioration of his marriage also cost him his relationship with his daughter. "My wife became very cold to me," he said. "I learned to live with her like that, but soon I became a stranger in my own house. I come home from work to say to Kathy, 'Kathy, you come with me to the movies, huh?' But Kathy, she run to her mama and say, 'No, mama, I don't want to go with him.' Her mama always there." In 1954, Mrs. Capomaccio ordered her husband out of the house. Later, she was granted a divorce and given custody of the children. Mrs. Capomaccio had little formal education, but she was determined that her daughter would be well-schooled. Working as a cleaning woman, she managed to put Kathy and Antonio Jr. through high school. Kathy was considered highly intelligent by both classmates and teachers at Coral Gables High, where she graduated with honors and was a member of the Cavalettes, an elite marching group selected on the basis of popularity and scholastic ability. Although eligible for scholarships at several Florida schools, Kathy chose to accept a scholarship to attend Mississippi College, a rigid segregated institution in the small town of Clinton. Her racism and anti-Semitism were reinforced at the college. Dr. W. M. Caskey, a hardline segregationist advisor to Governor Ross Barnett, was one of her favorite professors. Now remember, Ross Barnett sold out in the height of the civil rights, civil wrongs struggle. Ross Barnett was one of several governors that sold out, including George Wallace. If you want the details, you can dig them out. Dr. Caskey lectured students about the outside agitators coming into Mississippi and trying to destroy the state's white Christian culture. Kathy shared a room with Bonnie Barnes, whose father was Sidney Crockett Barnes, widely known as an extreme racist and anti-Jew. A fat, balding, and boisterous house painter, he was an avid follower of several hate propagandists, including Wesley Swift, the head of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian in Lancaster, California. Barnes often gathered friends together at his house to listen to the tape-recorded messages from Swift. Mrs. Capomaccio, and Kathy attended many of the sessions. There was a big spurt of that just before I got active of Wesley Swift's. They had groups all over the country. And somebody sent me a whole bunch of his cassettes at one time. I don't think I got any left around here now. But when he passed away, then Colonel William Gale took over, doing the same thing and preaching the same line, Christian identity. Although Kathy openly expressed her extremist views only rarely, some of her friends in Mobile began to notice a strain of anti-Jewism. She reacted coolly when Shirley Fulcher, a teacher whose brother dated Kathy and who would have been happy if they had been married, told her how much he enjoyed teaching at the predominantly Jewish Miami Beach High School and how much he admired the students' talents and abilities. At first, Fulcher was puzzled by Kathy's reaction, but she understood it better after a mutual friend told her Kathy expressed disappointment that her friend Shirley seemed to enjoy teaching at a school attended by so many Jews. Well, I think that's a perfect cover. I mean, I've known avowed white racists who taught in black schools, almost all black. And also in Jewish school. So it's actually a good cover. In 64, Barnes and his family moved from Miami to Mobile. Kathy and her mother continued to visit them, and it was on one of their visits that Kathy met Tommy Terrence. Both considered Barnes their mentor and thought of themselves as Christian soldiers pursuing a holy cause. Terrence called her dedication a passionate devotion and said the depth of intensity of it was hard for the average person to understand. With unselfconsciousness irony, he cited what he said was a letter written by an American communist breaking off an engagement with his fiancée as perhaps the best expression of such commitment among all radicals, left or right. We have a cause to fight for, a specific goal in life. We lose our insignificant identities in the great river of humanity. And if our personal lives seem hard, or if our egos seem bruised through subordination to the party, we are amply rewarded in the thought that all of us, even though it be a very small way, are contributing something new and better to humanity. If we take the zeal of the Reds, and the zeal of a lot of the whites and merge them together, we'd really have something, and that's what needs to be done. And that's, Hitler did a lot of that in Germany. Unfortunately, he ended up misguiding the whole damn thing, but he was recruiting more from the left than from the right. The right tended to be conservative middle class. The left, red types seem to be more working class. They were more working class. So that's why he sent Joseph Goebbels to Berlin to radicalize the working class, because at the time they were totally in control of the Reds, the Communist Party in Germany. So he went up to, Goebbels went to Berlin, and he took all the propaganda leaflets and posters of the left and just put their name on it. The National Socialist name on it, and pretty soon they had they controlled the power in Berlin. It didn't go without a battle. They fought in the streets, and a lot of National Socialists got killed. But it was funny the way Goebbels pulled the rug out from under the Marxists. Kathy's radicalization had reached the point where she embraced such fanaticism wholeheartedly. She joined the White Knights and the Americans for the Preservation of the White Race. She began dating a young farmer in Mendenhall, not far from Jackson, and fell deeply in love with him. But it was a one-sided affair, and the couple broke up after a brief romance. Not long afterwards, Kathy had taken a temporary job at the Universal Health Club in Jackson and begun to date Ralph Ainsworth, the club's amiable young manager. He adored Kathy, but was appalled when she pledged him to secrecy and told him she was in the Klan. Her commitment to the Klan was so strong that she would break a date with him to attend a nighttime rally. Despite the many hours he spent every week on the Klan-type activities, Kathy's associates outside of the hate groups had little inkling of her state of mind. She was known as a segregationist, but that did not set her apart from most of the Mississippi whites. She was not generally considered an extremist at Dueling Elementary School, where she and 11 other women taught about 360 students. Except for one black girl, all of the students were white. When the black girl was assigned to Kathy's fifth grade class, by all accounts, she treated her the same way she treated the white students, and that was smart. That was very smart. Her fellow teachers considered her mild-mannered and pleasant, although naive and easily influenced. At Dueling, she organized and published a mimeographed cookbook entitled Favorite Recipes of the Mothers of Our Fifth Grade Class. Included were two of her own recipes, Miss Kathy Capomaccia, Brunswick Stew, and Miss Kathy Capomaccia's Fig Cake. It was quite a different individual who attended the meetings of the White Knights and Americans for the Preservation of the White Race. At one APWR meeting, she vehemently denounced the communist Jewish conspiracy and declared she was being required to teach from textbooks containing communist propaganda. Kathy Ainsworth was a real model for female lone wolves. But do you hear anybody on the right wing giving her much lip service? I don't know. I don't read all this stuff from the right anymore. It's a waste of time. But the right wing never made a hero out of Kathy Ainsworth. On only one recorded occasion did she let her religious views slip into her homework. Schoolwork. She wrote a playlet that evoked the name of Christ so many times in connection with secular events that it caused a major flap among the parents of several Jewish students attending the school. In the end, the school principal decided that the playlet was too difficult for the children to perform as written, so the script was rewritten and numerous references to Christ omitted. It was the only time anyone could recall Miss Capomaccio getting involved in anything controversial. Oh, wouldn't it be so much better if we could get this religious nonsense out of the way? That affects people on both sides, and I know because I was a victim of it. Kathy and Ralph Ainsworth were married in August 67. A beaming Sidney Barnes gave away the bride. Mrs. Capomaccio was not particularly happy about the wedding. She had hoped her daughter would marry someone who shared their views on race and religion, but she continued to play a dominant role in her daughter's life, even selecting the site of the couple's honeymoon. For their wedding trip, they traveled to Arkansas. Oh, I hope they didn't go too deep into Arkansas. It's the Christ of the Ozarks, a monument. Wait a minute, I missed something here. For their wedding trip, they traveled to Arkansas to visit the Christ of the Ozarks monument erected by Gerald L. K. Smith, the notorious anti-Jew radio preacher from the 1920s and 30s. Kathy and her mother had once worshipped there. One thing you might not know is Gerald L. K. Smith's driver, who drove him all over the place, was none other than Wesley Swift, who became a preacher, and then after Gerald L.K. Smith died, branched off into Christian Identity. Gerald L.K. Smith was more or less a straight Protestant preacher. However, I believe he was critical of the Jews, because I ran into a Jew one time in California that damned the Zionists and the rabbis. And so Gerald L.K. Smith had him speak on his platform when he gave speeches. And this guy gave a speech against that segment of the Jews. And so he was a Jew. As Rockwell used to say, a tame Jew. If Ralph Ainsworth ever attended any Klan rallies or other meetings of hate groups, the FBI was not aware of it. An informant told the Bureau that Kathy always attended alone and that Klan members considered her husband to be both a square and unenlightened. Ainsworth was madly in love with his wife, but disapproved of her membership in the White Knights. He did not disagree with the Klan's goal of preserving segregation, but he opposed its tactics and was so concerned about Kathy's safety while she was traveling alone to attend nighttime rallies that he bought her a 6mm Browning automatic pistol to carry in her purse. The strain of the bombing investigation and the demands of protecting Mayor Key, Chief Gunn, Police Chief Gunn, and several Jewish residents was proving too much for the Meridian, Mississippi police. They decided they needed outside help. Scarborough suggested that Chief Gunn get help from a special unit known as the Goon Squad that the State Highway Patrol used to harass so-called hate groups. At Sheriff's Gunn's request, the Highway Patrol assigned 6-man squad to Meridian. In other words, a gang to give white racialists problems. Gunn supplied the squad with photos of suspects, and Scarborough noted in a memo, "We fully explained to them what we wanted done and left it in their judgment when and how to carry it out." In other words, do whatever you want to them physically or whatever. The FBI also had decided it was time for more extreme measures. As Frank Watts put it, it was time to fight fire with fire. Even though he had no hard evidence, he was convinced that Terrence had bombed the synagogue, and he felt the quickest way to nail Terrence would be to lay a trap for him. To do that would involve the unpleasant chore of recruiting the Roberts brothers as informants. But Watts figured, you just have to deal with the scum of the earth to catch the scum of the earth. The Bureau had been gathering evidence linking the Roberts brothers to attacks on some of the black churches, but the priority now was not the church burnings, it was the bombing of a synagogue. Well, of course, the Jews have to come first. Once the Jews were attacked, Watts said, it was a different ball game. Yeah, this wasn't just a local across the railroad track case, it involved the whole United States. People were putting pressure on senators and congressmen in Washington, save the Jews, and demanding that action be taken against the terrorists. As a result of that pressure, Hoover decreed that every morning, 7 days a week, Watts was to file a teletype to Washington, keeping the director abreast of every development, especially about the Jews. Watts' boss, Roy Moore, summed it up the most threatening situations. Quote, there were four things that they had on the drawing board. There was the killing of the chief, doing away with me, placing a case of dynamite in a synagogue over there and when all the congregation was in it. And the fourth thing they had on the drawing board, there were four of them, they planned to get one of the prominent Jews who was collecting the reward money for the city fathers, in other words, hit money to hit the Klan. While Watts and Jack Rucker pressed their plan to turn Alton Wayne and Raymond Roberts into informants, Chief Gunn turned his attention to a third brother, Lee, a policeman and a known Klan supervisor who was believed to have a drug problem. He was a large man with a bullying nature. Once, after spotting Reverend Charles Johnson, a young black minister, making an illegal U-turn in downtown Meridian, he rushed up, put a pistol in Johnson's head and shouted, quote, you don't do that, nigger, or I'll blow your brains out, unquote. Gunn, looking for a way to get rid of Lee Roberts, assigned Scarborough to work up a case against him based on the rumors that Roberts had falsified prescriptions for drugs. Later, Marie Knowles typed up a report of Scarborough's investigation. Armed with the report, Gunn told Roberts, you can resign or I'm going to put your ass in a Parchman State prison. Roberts resigned. To unnerve Raymond and Alton Wayne, Watts and Rucker began to dog their footsteps everywhere they went. The agents arranged to run into them into the street in Meridian. They dropped by the 49 Club South, where Alton Wayne was a bouncer. They made a point to see them at the Davis Grill, or sidling up to them at the Widowman's restaurant, where the brothers frequently went for coffee. It got so that wherever Raymond and Alton Wayne went, whenever they looked around, there was to be Watts and Rucker, FBI agents, watching them. And whenever circumstances permitted, one of the agents delivered a cryptic warning. Quote, time is of the essence, the agents would say. Or, if you know what's good for you, you'll meet with us privately, unquote. The encounters usually resulted in little more than verbal sparring. The brothers insisted they had nothing to say to the Klan or to the FBI. Watts and Rucker were not discouraged. They saw this shadow boxing as an exercise in preparing the Klansmen mentally for the idea of associating with the FBI. The real approach would come through Tom Hendricks, the brothers' attorney. Ironically, the Klan itself had softened up Hendricks for the FBI's approach. Though he had represented members of the White Knights, recently he had experienced two nasty encounters with Klansmen that were followed by anonymous calls threatening his life. One involved his decision to represent a black youth involved in a fight with a young white boy that led three hard-eyed Klansmen to confront Hendricks at the courthouse and demand, "You gonna represent that nigger against our boy?" Unquote. The other situation grew out of Hendricks' refusal to represent a Klansman who wanted to bring charges against Meridian police for harassing him. Initially, Hendricks had rebuffed the FBI's overture. Now alarmed at the Klan's threats, he sought out both Watts and Scarborough and told them what had happened. If he could remain absolutely anonymous, Hendricks said he would act as a go-between with the Roberts brothers. He wanted no one in the FBI outside Watts and Rucker to know the role he would play. And within the Meridian Police Department, he would work with no one but Luke Scarborough. Watts assured Hendricks on both points. Then he told the lawyer that he wanted the Roberts brothers to attend a prayer meeting at his house, and that if they fail to show up, their asses are going to be in big trouble. Scarborough filed a report saying Hendricks was ready to help us any way he could. Though he did not know it, Hendricks' stipulation about working only with Scarborough matched the agent's thinking perfectly. They'd already learned that the soft-spoken Meridian detective was a man they could rely on. They had begun to build a special relationship with him months earlier when they first learned what the White Knights were shifting their focus from Jackson to Meridian. Another plus in Scarborough's favor was that in 1964 he attended the FBI National Academy 16-week training program for municipal police officers. They do that all the time. They come from all over the country. Though he did not know... Oh, no. The FBI agents began by having coffee with Scarborough and Widman's. Soon the three of them were fishing together and discussing mutual problems. First and foremost, the Klan. Watts considered Scarborough a natural on it for the team, someone who would go along with what Roy Gunn, the chief, wanted, but at the same time was a real professional, unquote. Solidly built, 5'11", 185 pounds, with wavy salt and pepper hair, Scarborough had the clean-cut, neatly dressed image of the FBI that they liked. He was a hard worker, and despite his low-key manner, he was tough and resourceful. Recalled to active duty in the Marines during the Korean War, he had been among those cut off at the Chosin Reservoir in the bitter cold and winter. Incidentally, I believe it's the numbers about 8,000 skeletons of U.S. Marines that died at the Chosin Reservoir that we've never gotten back, and it doesn't seem to be much, they're not too anxious to even get them back. The Marines fought their way out, bringing their dead and wounded with them. They didn't bring too many with them, and Scarborough, his hands and feet frostbitten, was sent back to the Naval Hospital in Pensacola, Florida. At Christmas, his condition was judged too serious for him to travel, but he persuaded a doctor to approve a 3-day leave and to hitchhike the more than 200 miles to Meridian. let out on the highway almost 2 miles from his house, he hobbled the rest of the way to see his wife and newborn baby. Later in 51, Scarborough became a Meridian policeman at $270 a month, though he got only two days a month off. He earned extra money by parking cars at ball games and driving mental patients to the state sanitarium at Whitfield, 95 miles away, for a $10 round-trip fee. Watts and Rucker also knew that they could count on Scarborough when it came to the Klan. As a kind of test, they had asked him to help when J.B. Stoner's National States Rights Party scheduled a rally near Meridian. Scarborough talked to the owners of the land where the rally was to be held. The rally was canceled. So much for free speech. With Scarborough as a trusted ally and Hendricks offering to cooperate, Watts decided it was time to strike. He confided in Hendricks his plan to use the Roberts brothers to lay a trap for the two top hitmen of the White Knights, Danny Joe Hawkins and Thomas Terrence. Unfortunately, Terrence, of course, was a good man in the beginning, but he survived the assassination plot in Jackson, where Kathy Ainsworth was murdered. So he went to prison. He was in prison up in North Carolina, I believe it was, someplace. And he went back into Christianity, and then when he got out, he became a preacher of a church and condemned the Klan and everything else. The way a lot of people do, they lose their resolve. And he died about 5 years ago, as I recall, maybe more. And the softening up of the Roberts brothers had apparently worked. When Hendricks approached them, the two Klansmen agreed to meet with the FBI agents. At Watts' instructions, Hendricks drove the brothers to Watts' split-level house late one night. The lawyer drove directly into the garage, and Watts quickly pushed the button to bring down the automatic door. He ushered them into a den that adjoined the garage, and the agents got right down to business. The FBI wants your cooperation to get those responsible for blowing up the synagogue, Watts told the Roberts. And this is a fair warning. We know you've been involved in some of the violence around here, and if you don't cooperate, we're going to hold you responsible. You sons of bitches are going to have to answer for it. It was not like an interview, Watts said later. It was more like you are going to cooperate meeting. He assured the brothers that if they delivered Hawkins and Terrence, they stood to get the reward money collected by the city officials and the Jewish community, as well as recommendations for lenient treatment in any future criminal cases. Failure to cooperate, they were warned, would make them a focal point of the investigations that already had linked them to the Klan violence. I understand that reward money that the Roberts brothers got, they spent it on new cars. That's what somebody told me that. The FBI immediate goal was to nail Terrence and Hawkins, but it was also hoped to persuade Raymond and Alton Wayne to testify against Sam Bowers and perhaps L.E. Matthews. Both the Bureau and the Meridian Police had compiled intelligence indicating that Matthews, a well-to-do Jackson electrical contractor, was prepared to replace Bowers as Imperial Wizard of the White Knights when Bowers began his 10-year prison sentence in Philadelphia case. Although convinced that Matthew was the White Knights' chief bomb maker, the FBI had not been able to bring a single charge against him. In fact, Matthews boasted that he'd never spent a day in jail despite the FBI's constant attention. The Bureau was so frustrated that at one point, officials arranged for 3 carloads of agents to maintain 13 straight days of around-the-clock open surveillance on his house in the rural area near Florence, about 10 miles south of Jackson. I think that's the house that I visited and met Bowers and Matthews and Matthews' son. When Matthews' mother, then in her mid-80s, encountered the agents and asked what they were doing, one of them replied, "We're watching your son. He's a dangerous criminal." Although obtaining evidence against Matthews and others was high on the FBI priority list, negotiating with the brothers to get testimony was not without its risk. Dealing with Wayne, who killed two people, was weird, Watts said. But we had to do something to protect innocent people that were being targeted. Significant word is innocent. I figured I sure deserved my paycheck. You had to stay up one step at a time ahead of them. You knew they were capable of doing anything. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls, on Thursday, the 5th of November. And we'll get back into this later. Tomorrow, I don't know what we'll do. I was looking for a book written by an avowed National Socialist from Britain that wrote a book similar to the books on the order. Now, I thought it was really a good book. It was about unconventional warfare in England, which most of the operations over there is just right-wing stuff and a few parades and waving the flags and all that kind of stuff. And they don't get real serious. A few of them do, and some of them have gone to prison. So we're not putting everybody in the same barrel. 14-5, I'll be back tomorrow.
I did what I did for the good of the realm. The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left once we abandon the lie?
Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all.
Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail, but never get to try again. Fall breaks them. And some, given a chance to climb, they refuse. They cling to the realm. Or the gods. Or love. Illusions. Only the ladder is real. The climb is all there is.